From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We begin with the coronavirus and questions about testing here in the United States. The government's top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci, testified at a congressional hearing about this yesterday and described the availability of testing here as failing.
The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
Let's talk about all of this with NPR's Richard Harris. And Richard, the CDC and public health labs have only tested about 13,000 patient specimens since January. That's about as many people that were tested in South Korea in just one day. Why is the U.S. so behind on this?
Well, let me give you a little bit of the backstory. Actually, the CDC was up and running very quickly with its own test, but it could only run at the CDC in Atlanta. They tried to mass produce that so they could distribute it to public health labs, but there were technical problems with that test once they had done that. And instead of deciding to, well, to turn to other countries and say, hey, let's use some of the tests that the WHO is distributing, they said, we'll fix our own test. And unfortunately, that took weeks and weeks and weeks. So that put us way behind the testing curve.
Okay, so what is the United States doing now to ramp up testing?
Well, the other thing about the CDC test was it was only really designed to run on small batches because they wanted it to run in these public health labs. And when the public health labs run tests, they're really just sort of trying to do flu surveillance. They're not trying to diagnose a bunch of people. So it was, even from the start, it was a low throughput test. So that was a bad start for where we are today. The good news is at first a public health lab in New York State said, we're going to make a high throughput test. They did that.
Right.
It was approved by the FDA for use. And so that's up and running. That's now being shared throughout New York State, where there are a lot of coronavirus cases. And now what's happening is we're seeing some of the commercial labs hop in, and Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp and so on, and they have the capacity to scale up. They haven't scaled up yet, but they have the tests that can do that, and many other companies are jumping in. So now at this late date, we are finally seeing the beginning of that curve.
You know, there's something else, though. We have received numerous reports of people being denied tests because they don't meet the criteria of having traveled abroad or been exposed to someone, but they may be showing symptoms, a high fever and some other things. How effective are these rules?
Well, the CDC has relaxed its rules, but the problem is because the tests are still in such short supply in states and localities, a doctor says, I want my patient tested, and the state lab says, sorry, we're going to say no because it's not urgent enough for the testing capacity we have. That, again, will gradually ease up as testing becomes more readily available. But, you know, that's it's a huge frustration right now. If you're sick today, you don't really care if you're going to be, if the testing situation will be better in 2 weeks, right?
Right. And is that kind of the timeline is 2 weeks?
Well, I wish I knew the timeline. I think things will be better in 2 weeks, but whether people will actually be able to go to their doctor and say, I need a test and get it in 2 weeks, that remains to be seen.
That's NPR's Richard Harris. Thank you so much, Richard.
Pleased to talk with you, Tanya.
And this is clearly also a big political story. Let's bring in our Friday political roundtable. Beth Fooey is senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. Beth, good to speak with you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And also Jesse Holland, host of Weekend Journal on C-SPAN. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. Beth, let's start with you. Coronavirus, clearly top of the agenda in Washington today. President Trump planning a news conference later this afternoon, and I understand he is expected to break some news. What are you hearing?
Yeah, so NBC News is reporting, as are others, that the president has decided to declare a national emergency around coronavirus, which will open up a lot of money, hopefully billions of dollars, aimed at fighting the spread of the infection. We don't know specifically where he wants to target that money, but we will learn more at the news conference.
Jesse, this would be a far cry from even yesterday when the president said that this virus was going away. What's going on? Why the shift?
Well, because you're seeing it get more and more public. We're seeing more and more people announcing that they have actually tested positive. In fact, the Miami Herald is reporting this morning that Miami's mayor, Francis Suarez, has said that he has tested positive for COVID-19. And he was in that same group that met with the Brazilian officials in South Florida with President Trump. So we're seeing more and more people actually testing positive. So the president has to act, because if we don't, we don't know what kind of trouble our country is going to be in.
Well, in fact, a lot of people were wondering why President Trump didn't declare an emergency on Wednesday night in his address to the nation in the Oval Office. Let's hear a moment from that speech.
This is the most aggressive and comprehensive effort to confront a foreign virus in modern history. I am confident that by counting and continuing to take these tough measures, we will significantly reduce the threat to our citizens, and we will ultimately and expeditiously defeat this virus.
Beth, in that address, the president gave incorrect information about his travel ban from Europe, which incidentally starts tonight. And many people are now saying that that moment in the Oval Office will stand out when history judges his response to this outbreak. Do you think that's fair?
Well, what we can say and what we know is that President Trump has been sort of reluctant to embrace the severity of this situation until very recently. The Oval Office address was perhaps the first step in that direction. Obviously, this press conference today is yet another step. But early on, it was not something that he wanted to get out in front of. And whether that's because he didn't know the level of severity or whether he saw it as a political risk, you know, we will you know, be talking about that and thinking about that for a long time. But perhaps now that he is stepping out and is going to free up this money, the situation will receive the level of intensity that it needs. Because as we know from our public health experts, it's a situation that requires this level of focus. And certainly state and local officials have trended in that direction and did so, you know, days before. Governor Andrew Cuomo here in New York, Governor Inslee in Washington State, Governor Hogan in Maryland has just shut public schools. The local and state level officials have acted quickly, and that will perhaps be the way to at least initially halt the spread.
Well, in fact, those local officials are saying they have to do that because they are getting so much contradictory information from the federal government between the administration and the White House. One of the biggest questions is this issue of testing. Why in the world aren't more tests available? The president and the White House have said testing is widely available and you can get it. The reality is quite different. Jesse, more on that. Where is this miscommunication on the federal government coming from?
Well, here's the thing that we're seeing right now. We're seeing people having to turn to their local officials instead of turning to the federal government to figure out what they do next. Now, one thing we do know that earlier today, the Trump administration released a couple of $1 million for private companies to come up with their tests. But what we're going to see is that we really are depending on our state and our local officials to tell us what to do, how to survive this virus. Frankly, it doesn't look like many people right now can expect good information out of the federal government. So we're turning to our state, local, and frankly, even county and town officials to tell us how to survive this virus over the next few weeks.
Right. Also today, the House is expected to vote on a stimulus package, the Speaker Nancy Pelosi working with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin to find a compromise. Jesse, stick with you. Do you think that we will see lawmakers rise above partisanship in the next few hours and days?
Well, the answer is yes, because this affects almost all of their voting constituents. Nobody wants to be seen as saying we're going to be stingy with our money when people's lives are at stake. So I do think we'll see them rise above partisanship in the moment. The question is, can they do it long term? That's a question that's always unknown in Washington.
Well, and there's an election coming up. Democrats running for president are jumping into the fray. Here's Joe Biden yesterday.
This disease could impact every nation and any person on the planet. We need a plan about how we're going to aggressively manage here at home. You know, you all do know, the American people have the capacity to meet this moment.
And here's Bernie Sanders.
Because President Trump is unwilling and unable to lead selflessly, we must immediately convene an emergency bipartisan authority of experts to support and direct a response that is comprehensive.
Beth, both of those men trying to come across as presidential, are they succeeding?
It's such a strange situation to be in for these candidates and for this entire election. We've never seen anything like this, where a presidential election is playing out amidst a national crisis of this level. Biden, Vice President Biden, at this point, sort of the presumptive favorite to be the Democratic nominee, was certainly stepping out to assert sort of a presidential bearing and sort of take on the president while at the same time speaking what as though he were if he were in charge, what he would do. That's not to say that Bernie Sanders is out of this by any means, and he also chose the moment to assert himself in a presidential fashion. The two of them are also going to be debating on Sunday,
right.
A CNN debate, and will clearly be the topic A for the two of them, and we'll see how they decide to handle it between themselves.
Jesse, as if things couldn't get any busier, there is an election on Tuesday. Important states: Florida, Ohio, Illinois, Arizona. All of those states under a state of emergency. How do you expect this to play out there?
Well, as we all know, the elections are decided by turnout.
Right.
So the question becomes, who turns out for a presidential primary election on Tuesday? Will Joe Biden's voters turn out? Will Bernie Sanders' voters turn out? Can you vote absentee in those states? That's a question that right now no one can answer. So we don't know what the race is going to look like after Tuesday because, frankly, we don't know who's going to show up for elections or even if those states are going to cancel or delay their election.
Lots to think about. Jesse Holland, host of Weekend Journal on C-SPAN, and Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC and MSNBC. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Change is hard. Transitions can be even harder. But they're also an opportunity to explore and discover and reimagine things you thought you knew. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. And with all this in mind, we've decided to make my entire first episode about reinvention. Subscribe or listen right now.
We're going to take a little break from our coronavirus coverage to talk about something we all think about, and that's social class. The majority of us, 70% according to Pew Research, believe we're part of the middle class. But as income inequality grows, there is a new distinct class that is also growing, and our next guest calls it the aspirational class. Elizabeth Curet Halkett is a professor at the University of Southern California, and she joined me in studio last week to talk about this new burgeoning class.
In your book, you coined this term, aspirational class. What exactly is it, and who's a part of it?
So the aspirational class is really unified not so much by money. We often think about class as something to do with socioeconomics.
Yes.
And while they tend to be better off than most Americans, the real relationship between the people in the aspirational class is their shared sense of social and cultural practices and norms. A really good example that we'll all know is shopping at Whole Foods.
Yes.
And when I was thinking about this book, one thing I noticed is, of course, you had very well-to-do people shopping at Whole Foods. But I also remember going to Whole Foods and seeing lots of people who, you know, young college students and graduate students. And mm-hmm. I knew my friends who were screenwriters, you know, looking for a gig were shopping at Whole Foods. And it was, you know, maybe they shouldn't spend $5 on strawberries, but they were doing it because they were organic and they were local and they cared about those values. And it was mm-hmm. it's those values that I think unify the aspirational class.
I want to talk more about those values. But first, I want to talk a little bit about this core argument of your book, which really draws from the social theorists who believe consumption is part of how we define ourselves. It's a signal of our socioeconomic position, as you mentioned, with Whole Foods. What does this theoretical concept look like in other ways in the real world?
So it plays out in two different ways. So I was really inspired by Thorstein Veblen. And, you know, a lot of people don't know who he is, but they know the term conspicuous consumption,
yes.
which is the use of material goods to show social position. And what I started thinking about when I was writing this book was the fact that it's not about fancy watches and shoes anymore in the way that it might have been in the 1980s and certainly in Veblen's time when we think about his famous silver spoons,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that, you know, you could own a silver spoon and it wasn't more useful than a spoon of a different metal, but you could own one. So that must mean you had enough money to. And
that's
so
right.
We don't really do that as much today because material goods are so omnipresent that you can, you know, even if we thought about like knockoff culture, you know, people can kind of fake that. But what they can't fake is the time and the accrual of knowledge to make certain decisions about consumption.
Hmm.
And so some examples of this are the upper middle class spends, you know, something like 8 times more exercising than the lower income groups.
Hmm.
And you see...
in the way of exercise classes, those types of things.
Exercise classes, which are expensive.
Yes.
If you think about a yoga class or a Pilates class. But also they have the time in the sense of flexibility. So I think that that's something, if you really contrast, say, someone who's an hourly worker to even someone who has a very high-pressure job, like a lawyer, but they still have some control over their schedule and the ability to take, you know, take lunch hour to go to the gym. And there is a gym down the street from where they work. And so I think that that's a really good way of seeing it, not just in terms of expense, as in it's expensive to exercise, but also in terms of day-to-day habits.
Yes.
And time.
Time.
Yes.
Absolutely. We all know it. We all think about it. We all kind of put ourselves in a particular class. But there is no real definition for social classes, truly, official definitions. What do you think is missing for us in really thinking about that? And do we actually need that? Do we need a defined idea of what is a particular class? What does that mean for us?
I think that is the problem with social class, is that I think it is hard to pinpoint these days because it's not just about money anymore. And, you know, if we think about, you know, the kid who graduates from Yale or Princeton with a poetry degree, you know, he's not going to work on Wall Street, but he has, you know, a higher social class than that guy who worked so hard as a real estate broker and, you know, lives in New Jersey. And that it's very confusing. But I think what we really see now, and I think this is actually why it's so hard, is that because culture and knowledge are so much a part of social class and position now, they take a long time to earn.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where social class is somewhat intractable now in this country, and it becomes hard. Even the conduits in which we are mobile, like college, they are hard to get into now. It's not how do you become the kind of you know, student that a college wants. Well, it's not simply just writing, you know,
a great essay and exactly. Having a 4.0. Yeah,
exactly.
We also can't talk about class in this country without talking about race. And all of these markers that you're talking about, Whole Foods, NPR, the coffee shops that you go to, the Mommy and Me classes, they also kind of signal something else, and that's white. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And I will say I'm all of those things, and I'm not white. Mommy and Me down to Whole Foods, down to working at NPR.
You know, that's a really great observation. I think one of the reasons is because what we've seen historically is that the upper end of the socioeconomic totem pole has been historically white. And so there is this dominant hegemony around the practices of upper middle class white people. And I think that that, again, actually adds to the observation you made before, which is that it makes people uncomfortable. And minorities tended to be greater conspicuous consumers. And this is because when you are a minority, you feel you have to prove yourself more.
Yeah.
And so you conspicuously consume to signal, I'm here, mm-hmm. I fit in. And so, you know, in a way, if we contrast that in the other end, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, there's this, you know, kind of joke about the beat up barber coat and the sweater with the moth holes. And,
yep.
You know, they don't have to try
yeah.
because their social position is clear.
Yeah.
And so I think that that is a really important observation. And it also is, I think, another... It'll be interesting to see over time how that evolves.
Mm-hmm.
Some sociologists talk about this notion of being a cultural omnivore, which is this idea that, you know, you do go to Whole Foods, but you love the taco stand down the street from you.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of sense of like the different kinds of, you know, ethnic and cultural consumption habits you have. But again, I think it's a luxury to do that. Mm-hmm. And so do we return again to the fact that even if social class today is not simply about money, it has historical ties to upper middle class white people who have had money over time when other groups have not.
You know, I'm thinking about this is an election year. And so in addition to things like juicing and cycling and all of these signals to folks, the candidates we support are also a means of signaling to people about not only our political ideas, but our status. Is that something that you also think about?
Absolutely. And one of the things that was really interesting when my book first came out was it was on the heels of the 2016 election. The people who engaged with the book in the public sphere kept talking about that my book was representative of, you know, some of the divisions, the cultural divisions in this country. You know,
socially and politically.
Absolutely. One person who interviewed me set it up with a hillbilly elegy. So this is one story of America. And then these are the coastal elites and their cultural practices, which are alien to everyone other than themselves. It's so insular. And this is what's wrong with America. So I believe this, and I'm working on another book right now, that we have to, more than even socioeconomics, it's cultural divisions in this country and an understanding cultural cohesion that's going to help things. If we could start understanding each other a little more instead of the conversation being about cultural divides, which exist, it may actually be more of a story of cultural cohesion and to find those through lines and actually to see that you can live in Los Angeles and have more in common with someone who lives in small town Minnesota than you do maybe to someone who lives in the neighborhood adjacent to you. And that's a better picture and actually a more hopeful one, because no one's saying we don't have things to repair in this country. But what we might be able to say is there is an America, as in one that is tied to one another.
This book really lays this out in great detail. But now we know it. What does it mean? And how do we move forward?
We don't seem to be talking to each other.
Yeah.
And so that's about something that's not just money. Hmm. That is about culture, and that's about cultural cohesion. And I think, to me, one of the most important things is to first try to find what we might have in common and also find out how we can provide access to cultural capital. And that's something I think is missing now, is that, you know, I think a lot of social mobility depends on things that, frankly, start at age 5. Hmm. And so it's not as simple as like
we're talking about education. Yeah.
Education, absolutely.
Right.
You completely get it. It's about access to a diverse and enriched life. And that real actually is quite rarefied today.
Elizabeth Currid Halkett is the James Irvine Chair of Urban and Regional Planning and Professor of Public Policy at the University of Southern California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Tanya. Thank you.
Seattle is a very different place right now as the coronavirus spreads. Large gatherings are canceled, all schools are closed, and people are practicing safe social distancing to avoid contact. We want to take a closer look now at ride sharing. Drivers in Seattle will meet early next week with Uber and county health officials, and their goal is to hammer out more detailed coronavirus guidance. Drivers have a lot of questions about how to protect themselves and their customers. They can easily carry 15 to 20 passengers a day and have no idea if any of them is sick. Joshua McNichols from member station KUOW has more.
Late last month, Uber driver Derek Kay picked up a passenger in Seattle and drove him 12 minutes to Google's offices just north of downtown. The man told Kay he had just arrived from Milan, Italy.
And he started telling me about the coronavirus fallout that was happening there around Milan. And he was saying he was kind of glad to get out of there.
Kay remembers the passenger coughing into his hand.
And after I dropped him off, he was my last rider. I took the leather wipes that I had in the car and I wiped down the seats.
Kay also opened the car windows.
But, you know, I kept thinking about that rider as the news kept going on, and especially as I started getting symptoms, and thinking that he'd been right there.
The symptoms Kay developed a few days later were consistent with the coronavirus. He tried to get tested but couldn't. Still, just to be safe, he turned the back half of his house into a quarantine zone. Kay's story illustrates a fear held by many Uber and Lyft drivers at this moment, getting sick and getting others sick. Uber and Lyft declined to be interviewed and pointed to safety advice they'd sent to drivers. In an email, an Uber spokesperson said drivers will be allowed to decline a customer without penalty if they suspect the virus.
I wouldn't say it's an effective piece of guidance because how would the driver be able to know who is infected?
That's Ahmed Mumin, a full-time Uber driver and the director of the Seattle Rideshare Drivers Association. Mumin says drivers need useful guidance on questions like, are there some places they should not pick up passengers? Can a driver protect themselves by opening a window? And he's wondering if Uber can pay drivers who self-quarantine.
Is there any way that Uber could help those drivers stuck in their houses for 14 days? No income. Uber was the only source of income.
Earlier this week, Uber and Lyft confirmed they'll provide funds to infected drivers and to drivers quarantined by a public health agency. They haven't released details yet. Meanwhile, there are things drivers can do to keep people safe, says Dr. Guy Palmer. He's an expert on emerging infectious diseases at Washington State University. He says drivers should use an alcohol or bleach wipe to wipe down door handles and seatbelt buttons after each customer.
The back of the seat, the headrest, just quick wipe downs of those would reduce the risk of transmission.
The virus mostly spreads through contaminated surfaces.
The virus is encapsulated in a what's called a droplet, some kind of fluid, and then the driver touches that surface, then touches their face.
He spoke via Skype. Uber and Lyft now say they'll distribute a limited supply of cleaning products to drivers free of charge. It won't be nearly enough for every driver to disinfect every car after every rider, but the move begins to help drivers protect themselves, their families, and their customers. For NPR News, I'm Joshua McNichols in Seattle.
We'll get back in a moment to our lead story today, the coronavirus. But first, a look at the 2020 census, which is underway this week and will help determine how states redraw their electoral maps. That's something that's typically the purview of the political party that happens to be in power. But some states are trying something different this time. At least 17 have committed to using independent redistricting commissions or other non-traditional methods to prevent partisan gerrymandering. One of them is Colorado. Jessica Shipley is leading the effort at the state's nonpartisan legislative council. Jessica, welcome.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you. And so you're setting up a 12-member commission, four Republicans, four Democrats, and four independents that will eventually rely heavily on the data that we're getting from this year's census. Tell me more. How will this work?
So we're actually setting up two 12-member commissions, one for congressional redistricting and one for state legislative redistricting. These two commissions will be chosen by two different panels of three judges each, and they will choose from a pool of applicants, sort of a 150-person pool where they'll choose four Republicans, four Democrats, and four unaffiliated people.
And let's step back from the nuts and bolts just a little bit and talk about why you're doing this. It started with a pair of constitutional amendments passed by Colorado voters back in 2018. Of course, this was a reaction to a debate that we've been having across the country about partisan gerrymandering. Last year, the Supreme Court ruled that it was beyond the scope of the federal courts, so some states are stepping in. What have you heard, just generally speaking, about what voters in Colorado think about why doing this is so important?
Well, I'll tell you that in the past, congressional redistricting has been in the purview of the legislature. And for eight of the last 10 times we've done this, that plan, there was no agreement on it. It ended up in the courts and the courts decided. I think people just are ready for different input from a different perspective. This has become more in the public zeitgeist. People understand it a little bit more and understand how it doesn't necessarily benefit the people as a whole to make districts that are not in any way competitive.
So the way that you've set this up, four Republicans, four Democrats, four independents, do you think that that's going to eliminate the ability for partisanship to infect the process?
Well, what I can tell you is the restrictions on who cannot be a member of these commissions make an attempt to do that. I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm not going to say that it's going to fix every problem and pull every bit of partisanship out of these things. But no elected officials can apply. Nobody who's worked for an elected official can apply. No lobbyists, no people who have been employed by one of the major political parties. So they've really tried with these constitutional amendments to pull as much of that out as possible. The other thing that they've done with these constitutional amendments is that they've put the responsibility for actually drawing the maps onto nonpartisan staff. Me, my staff, will be responsible for actually creating the maps. And then we can take input from the public. We can take input from the commission to amend the maps. But the initial work is done by nonpartisan staff. I think that's another point. In the past, maps have sort of come in to the commission and we don't really know where they're coming from.
As you know, Colorado is a growing state. The population has gone up so much that you might actually get a new congressional district after this census is done. How will that be factored into the work that you're doing, and how much more complicated will it be because of that?
I don't know that it'll be tremendously more complicated. We do believe we're going to get an 8th congressional district, and when it comes time to redistrict, we'll sort of not start from scratch, but kind of start from scratch, because we're not allowed to take into account incumbents or current districts or anything like that. We really have to stick with the criteria that are laid out in the constitutional amendments.
Which are what? I mean, what are you looking for when you draw a map so that it's fair?
So the number one thing is population equality. And then we take into account some other things. We want to make our districts contiguous and as compact as possible. We want to take into account political boundaries like counties, towns, things like that. The very last thing that we're allowed to take into account is political competitiveness.
Other states are looking at this. There are new citizen initiatives proposing redistricting reforms in Virginia, Arkansas, Nevada, Oklahoma, and Oregon. Do you think that this is the way of the future?
I think so. I think it makes a lot of sense, personally speaking. As a member of the nonpartisan staff, we have no dog in this fight, honestly. We just want to provide the best information possible. There's less of a tendency to make districts that don't make sense, that, you know, have the weird shapes that
like the one that looks like a dog that spans 5 different towns.
Now, sometimes you do have to keep take into account that sometimes those strange districts have to do with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, mm-hmm. where they're trying to make sure that, say, a language minority is kept together. You just really want to make sure those people have somebody representing them that makes sense for them.
That's Jessica Shipley with the Legislative Council at the Colorado State House undertaking a new nonpartisan effort to redraw the state's legislative and congressional maps. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Having enough masks, gloves, and other equipment is crucial for healthcare workers facing the COVID-19 outbreak. There is a strategic national stockpile that the U.S. government controls, but no one actually knows what's already out there in the private sector. Some hospitals might have lots of extra masks, some not enough. And the hospitals, they aren't talking. Blake Farmer at WPLN in Nashville reports.
Protective masks have become a hot commodity even within hospitals. Tom Cooper's the supply chain director at Nashville General Hospital.
We get employees coming in saying, can I get a box of masks?
To take home?
To take home. Or to use here.
Even medical staff can get caught up in the coronavirus panic. General Hospital's supplier has already restricted orders, and this is precisely the kind of scarcity problem the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is trying to avoid during outbreaks.
It can result in panic purchasing, and this is where facilities buy as much as possible just to be on the safe side.
Megan Casey is a nurse epidemiologist with the CDC. She says right now, public health agencies only know what's in government stockpiles of protective gear, not what's in the storehouses of the nation's 6,000 hospitals. Last year, before COVID-19 emerged, the CDC hired the Center for Medical Interoperability in Nashville to build a platform where hospitals would share their real-time inventory. Typically, that's just a matter of linking up their electronic medical record system. Then the CDC could easily identify who has has the greatest need for face shields or protective gowns.
And it could also potentially provide a tool for hospitals to request personal protective equipment from state or local health departments, stockpiles, or even other hospitals that might have excess.
But the prospect of sharing supplies is where the business of healthcare makes cooperation hard, even in a crisis, says Melanie Thomas. She's the chief information officer at Nashville General, which is one of the hospitals trying out the platform on a pilot basis.
It's difficult and scary sometimes to share data and equipment, especially with your competitors, because you want to have the advantage.
Thomas acknowledges it's an easier decision for her taxpayer-funded public hospital, which doesn't have the money to build up a stockpile of emergency equipment.
That's never going to be our problem. We want the shared information.
Thomas wants to know where she can turn to resupply in a pinch. The other early participants include Northwestern Memorial in Chicago and Community Health Systems, a for-profit chain of nearly 100 hospitals around the country. The Center for Medical Interoperability's Tommy Ragsdale says COVID-19 has made a theoretical threat much more real and inspired bigger players to buy in.
It has definitely created different discussions at the hospital and health system level than we were having in October or November.
At this point, hospitals can't be forced to participate, but Ragsdale says he hopes they will see a benefit to the greater good. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
And Blake's story comes to us from NPR's reporting partnership with WPLN and Kaiser Health News.
Ohio, Maryland, and Michigan have become the first states to shut down all schools, public and private, over the coronavirus. Schools are also closed in New Mexico, Oregon, and Michigan. And in the coming days and weeks, more than 5 million kids will be at home. In Washington, Governor Jay Inslee has ordered all public schools in three Seattle-area counties to close for at least a month. That means life is changing for Dessa Jarman's three kids who attend Tacoma Public Schools. Dessa joins us now. Hey, Dessa, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And three kids home from school. You've got a lot on your plate, I'm sure. How are you doing today?
I'm relieved. We were pretty conflicted about whether or not our kids should be in school. So to just have that decision made now is a relief.
Well, in fact, I know that you took your kids out of school preemptively before the governor made this announcement. Why did you do that?
The decision was made given the governor's announcement the other day of not having any meetings over 250. I have one kid in high school. The high schools are big here. And it just seemed like the prudent thing to do, given that he'd also kind of hinted that they were going to be shutting the schools down anyway.
So you have one kid in high school. What about the other two? How old are they?
11 and 13. They are in middle school.
And so were you worried about their health? Was that part of your calculation?
No, their health was not an issue. My kids are pretty healthy. The concern was that they can be asymptomatic carriers. So they come home. They had been taking public transit home from school every day. When the first case was confirmed here, we stopped that. I started using my lunch break to go pick them up every day from school and bring them home. Mm-hmm. And the worry was spreading it and perhaps bringing it home. I have asthma. My husband has had two pretty bad bouts of pneumonia. So has decreased lung capacity. So the concern is there for us and our family.
Look, school districts are in a tough situation. We're all in a tough situation, really, across the country.
Oh, yeah.
Canceling school for thousands of kids, no small decision. Many of these kids in public schools don't have any other place to go. They rely on the schools for food. How did you feel about the way your school district handled this crisis up until now?
I was frustrated. I really felt like our district was waiting for someone to tell us to close. I didn't feel like they were preparing. If they were, they weren't communicating very well. My son's high school shut down for a day because of a case in the building. We were told it was limited exposure, but nobody would explain what that meant. And so I didn't know what the risk was to sending my son back to school. I did. And then when he came home, you know, it becomes kind of a chain of rumors at that point. I heard it was a child who was in a class that has contact with other children who have contact then with my son. So it was frustrating and nobody would answer anything. It made me feel like maybe my district was not prepared.
Yeah. The governor closed you down and closed those schools down for a long time, a month. So what now? What are your kids doing? Are they doing classes online or just staying at home?
We have not been given any direction. They had parent-teacher conferences today, and they've canceled all of those.
Are you working?
I do work, and I work in a job outside the home where I cannot work remotely. My husband is working remote, but my kids are pretty self-sufficient, so they would just be home anyway.
Self-sufficient, but not in school, not learning. What do you plan to do over the course of the next month? Are you going to let them out? Are you going to let them visit with friends? Are you going to force them to sit down with a book for a couple of hours every day?
We have not decided. My eldest daughter complained yesterday that she was bored already. Uh-huh. I threatened to buy math workbooks and have her do those. My son, who's in high school, is taking a Microsoft IT class that he can actually get a Microsoft certification for. His teacher already gave him the website and all the information that he needs to be able to continue that work from home. But as far as the other teachers go, I have no idea.
I'm sure you've had plenty of time to think about this already. You're going to have more in the weeks ahead. What else, though, is on your mind as the whole country goes through a national and global crisis, really?
It's scary. I wish we had actual numbers. I feel like our numbers here are suppressed. We didn't have any increase in positive cases yesterday here in our in Pierce County. And I don't know if I believe that. I think people are still kind of trying to come to grips with the reality of what's going on here. And it's surreal. You know, you go outside and you expect there to be less people and they're not. But then you go to the grocery store and everything is out. And that's weird.
Well, Dessa Jarman, thank you for your time. Your mom in Washington State, you've got three kids at the Tacoma Public School District. It has just closed down for the next month. Dessa, I don't know if it's any consolation. You are not alone. Millions of families across the country are really in the same situation. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. Good luck to everyone as well.
And we did reach out to the school district. We'll let you know if we hear anything back. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Researchers around the globe are working at a frenzied pace to create a vaccine against COVID-19.
The race is not against other vaccine developers. The race is against the virus and the epidemic.
Also, how the coronavirus outbreak is impacting hotel workers. That's next time on Here and Now.